A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll take a look at one of the first major American women composers. In fact, the first woman to have one of her works performed by a major symphony orchestra. That woman was Amy Beach, who was born 150 years ago this September. My guest will be Leanne Curtis, president and founder of the Women's Philharmonic Advocacy, which is highlighting Beach's music this year. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The 2017 Avery Fisher Prize has been awarded to flutist Claire Chase, a champion of new music who founded the International Contemporary Ensemble. Chase is the first flutist to receive this award, given by Lincoln Center to top-quality musicians who have brought music to new levels. In its release, Lincoln Center cited Chase's work as a soloist, collaborative artist, and activist for new music, having premiered more than 100 new works for flute. Chase previously received a MacArthur Fellowship and the American Composers Forum's Champion of New Music Award. Among her current projects is Density 2036, a 22-year project she launched in 2014, committed to commissioning a new work each year for flute solo through the 100th anniversary of Edgar Varèse's Flute Concerto. Previous recipients of the Avery Fisher Award include cellists Yo-Yo Ma and Lynn Harrell, violinists Sarah Chang, Gil Shaham, Joshua Bell, and Midori, the Kronos Quartet, and the Emerson String Quartet. Chase will receive the award, which comes with a $100,000 cash prize, at a ceremony at Lincoln Center in June. What do Washington, D.C., Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and Breckenridge, Colorado have in common when it comes to the arts? All three metropolitan regions each top the list of most vibrant arts communities when compared to other communities of their size. The report issued by Southern Methodist University's National Center for Arts Research ranked communities based on the number of nonprofit and cultural institutions per capita. One of the major findings was that some of the most vibrant communities based on this criteria tend to be either large cities with between 1 and 3 million residents or cities of less than 300,000. Among the top 10 communities of more than 1 million people were New York, Jersey City, Newark, New Jersey, Boston, Denver, Silver Spring, Frederick, Rockville, Maryland, Rochester, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Chicago. Regions between 100,000 and 1 million ranked in their top 10 included Ithaca, New York, Asheville, North Carolina, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bozeman, Montana, Hudson, New York, and Oneonta, New York were in the top 10 for small communities. The full report can be found at smu.edu/artsresearch. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. When the Boston Symphony Orchestra premiered Amy Beach's symphony, nicknamed the Gaelic Symphony because of its use of Irish tunes, in 1896, fellow New England composer George Whitefield Chadwick praised the work in a letter to her, saying she was now one of the boys. Indeed, Beach did achieve a relatively remarkable amount of acclaim, first as a pianist and later as a composer, at least for a woman in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Nevertheless, that hard-won success during her lifetime began to recede following her death in 1944. Now, as we approach the 150th anniversary of her birth in September 1867, there are some efforts to reacquaint audiences with her output, which include the symphony, a mass, chamber and choral works, and about 150 songs. One of the organizations leading that effort is the Women's Philharmonic Advocacy, a group dedicated to encouraging the performance of works by women composers from all classical music eras. Musicologist Leanne Curtis is its founder and board president, and I spoke with her recently about Beach's life, career, and legacy.
She was one of a group of musicians in the late 19th century, American composers who were really creating a school of American composition and really kind of putting that on the map in classical music, you know, so the classical music tradition and practice wouldn't be dependent on Europe. So those were composers, including Edward McDowell and George Chadwick, who were very well known in their day. And she was really respected as one of them. And then she was also well known as being the first, and very influential as being the first woman to achieve a very remarkable degree of success in classical composition. You know, she's the first woman to have a symphony performed by a major orchestra and to overcome a lot of barriers for women in classical music.
How was she able to overcome those challenges? Because they weren't little challenges at the time.
No, they weren't. It really, she did have some advantages. I mean, she was such a remarkable talent and recognized as a remarkable talent from childhood. I mean, because she was a child prodigy, you know, that she was composing music in her head and had these pieces that she had, you know, composed, memorized, you know, when she was 4 and 5 years old. And then once she learned to write, she wrote them all down. And once she was, you know, but like even before she could play piano, she had these pieces in her mind and said that she then, you know, got to the keyboard and played them. So, and then when she moved to Boston and her family moved to Boston, because I think they recognized she needed to have access to really high level teachers, you know, that she was taken up by a group of, you know, Boston figures. I mean, Boston sort of thought of itself as the Athens of its time, of having, you know, literary and artistic circles that were really very high level. And she was taken up by some of the men in those groups and really kind of nurtured and given a lot of opportunities. You know, so she had these public debuts as a pianist and was able to compose and publish. And then the man she married, Dr. Beach, Dr. H.H.A. Beach, he was a doctor, a physician, but he was one of that group of the Boston Brahmins, the literary circle and, you know, the Boston cultural elite. Well, he turned her away from performing and from playing piano because he didn't want his wife to be, you know, seen up on the stage. That was unseemly. And also he didn't want her to be, you know, earning her own money, you know, when he was the, you know, his role was the breadwinner of the family and the head of the family. But he encouraged her to compose. So that's, you know, there are a lot of good things we can say about the marriage, as well as also some negative things. But that really did help her concentrate and focus on composing. And then also he urged her to compose in large forms. Because previously, you know, she was 18 years old when she got married, but previously she had written mostly, you know, pieces for piano and pieces for voice and piano. But he urged her to write more large pieces and pieces for larger ensembles. And then those pieces got performed, too, because he really had some influence within the community.
Well, one of those later works was the her symphony, the Gaelic Symphony. And I understand that was written in part in response or in reaction to Dvorak's New World Symphony. What was the dynamic like on that? What prompted her to come up with those themes and those ideas for the Gaelic Symphony?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story because Dvorak was in the United States and was had been brought over to head a conservatory in New York City. And, you know, so people were excited to have him in the U.S. And so he made this statement that Negro melodies should serve as the basis of this American music that was being built. I mean, composers were interested in building an American school of composition that would be recognized as American. And he said Negro melodies should be used as the basis for that. And then that's heard in the new World Symphony. But when he made that statement, there was a lot of responses to it. And the Boston Herald actually invited some of the local Boston composers, including Amy Beach, to respond. And then they published the responses. And so Amy Beach said, you know, why would we up here in New England even be familiar with those Negro melodies? And for someone like her in the Northeast, she's much more likely to draw on Scottish or Irish themes of her own heritage and her own background. And so that's exactly what she did. That the Gaelic Symphony draws on Irish melodies that were published in an anthology in the 1840s.
Do we know much about her personal thoughts and her reflections about being a woman composer? Was it something that she chafed at, or was she grateful for the opportunity she had?
It was brought up, you know, in different ways. It was frequently brought up, and she often, you know, she wasn't always consistent in how she responded to it, but she did sort of become this maternal figure, you know, and was often pointed to as, you know, someone who proved that women could have success in every field, including music. But then she would also say that, of course, you know, women's role was to, you know, she has to take care of her housekeeping first and stuff like that. I mean, she would, you know, definitely try to sort of appeal to people on both sides of the argument, you know. So, but, you know, Dvorak actually did make a statement that he said that women hadn't achieved because they were not capable of achieving in music. And then she really lashed out at that and said, you know, women so often don't have access to good training. They don't have access to the instruments of the orchestra and to, you know, the way that men do. And so she said, you know, she really did address it and became very outspoken in contradicting Dvorak and saying, you know, if women have access to good training, of course they will achieve as much as men in this field.
So now, how much impact did she have in terms of paving the way for women to follow, or was it still really few and far between that were able to benefit from her experience?
I think she benefited a lot of women then, but, you know, there's always these sort of waves of progress in all these social issues. And then, you know, a lot of times then there's sort of like backlash or people get tired of the issue and forget about it. And everything kind of seems to, I don't know, revert to earlier situations, you know, not to compare it to now when, you know, certain people seem to want to take women back to where we were in 1950 or something like that. But, there was a group of Boston composers and you know, other women, and I think she really helped them at that time. Women like Mabel Daniels, you know, who was able to have a church job and be a professional organist as well as a noted composer. And then George Chadwick invited Helen Hopekirk to have a position as a piano teacher at the New England Conservatory. And, you know, so Chadwick, you know, knew Beach and knew about Beach and knew her personally, and so I think maybe the idea of having Hopekirk giving her this position might have been something that was facilitated by having Amy Beach, you know, be such a sort of a household name as a woman composer. And then, you know, her music was played very widely. I mean, she had some performances in Germany before World War One when she did a tour there, and that there was a kind of a window of opportunity for her. Like after her husband died, she could travel freely. And so she went to Europe and Germany and had some performances of her music then before World War One. And then it was very helpful to have good European reviews when you were looking for bookings back in the United States. So then she had more performances of her, you know, her symphony was performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I think there were some performances in Pittsburgh and Chicago. But after a certain number of years, well, you know, and styles changed. I mean, that her music did in part fall out of fashion, and especially I think after she died, she just was really forgotten. So then it was, I think, really part of the modern women's movement and interest in, you know, women composers to sort of rediscover her.
What is that status now in terms of the way she's viewed and the frequency with which her works are included in repertoire?
I think these rediscoveries, you know, it's always something that sort of happens from the, like a grassroots kind of thing. It's, you know, there's been a lot of interest in the chamber music, in the piano music, and it's always hardest to get the big pieces performed, I think, because it's such a big, big investment. You know, like there are lots of recordings of the piano pieces and some of the chamber pieces, like the piano quintet and the violin sonata, which are really, really great pieces. But, you know, of course, it's an easier thing to get a performance of those too. And then to get a commitment to perform the symphony, you know, it's a very large work. It's nearly 45 minutes long. It takes up, you know, a big chunk of the programming and rehearsing time for any orchestra. And, you know, has some quirky things in the instrumentation, you know, having a big ensemble, large ensemble, and lots of brass and trombones and everything. So this is the anniversary year, the 150th anniversary, and we are seeing a lot of orchestras programming her music, but not so much the big orchestras. So, you know, and I live here in Boston, and I guess I'm sort of obsessed with getting the Boston Symphony to play her symphony again. You know, they played it in her lifetime. But they're resistant to that, and you know they have a European conductor again, and I don't know, are more sort of European focused in their repertoire still, so which is one of those things that I just think it's a bias. But you know, other orchestras have taken up the big pieces, and there are luckily some good recordings now available of the big pieces too. Except not the mass. That still bothers me that there's no decent recording of her mass.
What are you doing to celebrate her 150th anniversary, and what else have you heard from other groups that are looking to do that as well?
Women's Philharmonic Advocacy, we did get going and prepared this new edition of the symphony, you know, which is not something that, you know, audiences will know that. I mean, it's not that there were big mistakes in the materials, but the materials that were used, like the parts, were hand-copied parts, and I think it's a lot easier for musicians today. They're not used to reading hand-copied parts, and so to have, you know, professionally engraved and printed parts, you know, where all the ledger lines are neat and even, and it's just much easier to read. We did that, and I think that's facilitating some of these performances that we're seeing. We had one already in March. The Michigan Philharmonic played the symphony, and then the first weekend of May, we have two performances going on, one in New Jersey, as you know, and another one in Maine, and a few more, you know, I think there was one in London already. So these are great things. And there's also some performances planned of the piano concerto. And there's a new edition in the works of the piano concerto, too, which we hope is going to be available for the anniversary year. And some of the other big pieces. I know here in Boston, a local community chorus is doing a performance of the mass, and that's great. So there are things going on. And I think actually there's a University of Maryland is going to do at least a movement of the symphony, and actually a Boston professional orchestra that plays outdoors at the Hat Shell, it's the Boston Landmarks Orchestra, they're going to do a movement of the symphony as well. So that'll be great. And they perform, you know, outside and get a lot of people, community people, and they're only a few blocks from where Amy Beach lived, you know, when she lived in Boston.
You mentioned the performance in London, and I did notice that the BBC magazine had her on the cover of its March issue. Is there a sense that she is getting giving people a better awareness of her now?
I think so. I hope so. And actually, to see her, you know, on the BBC, like, feature her as the composer of the month and stuff like that, that was very exciting, because I guess about 15 years ago, I was in England and talking to a choir director who really didn't know any of her choral music. And she wrote so much sacred music, you know, and it'd be great to have that become part of their choral tradition over there. And we are also planning a scholarly meeting about Beach. There'll be some performances, and that's at the University of New Hampshire in September, just a little bit after her birthday, which is September 5th. So we're getting some scholars, and, you know, which is, you know, maybe not earth shattering for the whole world, but, you know, get some scholarly information out there and articles, and that I think also helps bring her to light in a way, too.
Well, I wanted to turn to some of the other composers that you champion. Who would you say are some of the seminal women composers that have, you know, been left out or pushed aside as time went on?
I mean, you could kind of go back to like the history of, go through the history of music. And I mean, with, you know, Venetian opera starting with Claudio Monteverdi and in the early 17th century. And there was also like Francesca Caccini, who wrote an opera in 1620. So not that long after the first operas that are more familiar and, you know, from the early 17th century. I mean, 17th century nuns like Isabella Leonarda. And then like 18th century, there's the French composer Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, who was associated with the French court. But I always, I mean, she has a lot of cantatas and opera, and then a lot of, you know, music for smaller ensembles too, that I always, you know, I'm always telling, I don't know, keyboard players to play her music in, you know, instead of, I don't know, some of this Bach that we hear all the time. And it's like, and I'm not, you know, against Bach, but it just like, there's pieces that we hear all the time. So I don't know. Then the era of Mozart, there's Marianne Martinez, who studied with Franz Joseph Haydn, and she wrote only one symphony, but it is a good one. And then she also has a lot of vocal music, piano concerto, cantatas, oratorios, psalm settings, mass settings. There are also a lot of opera composers. Maria Antonia Walpurgis wrote some great operas in the 1760s. The one of them that's been recorded is called Telestri, Queen of the Amazons. I'm always thinking that's such an exciting title. And it is. It's a fun piece of music. And then the 19th century, there's one of my favorites is Louise Ferenc. She was a French composer who wrote three symphonies in the 1840s, and those are really lovely symphonies that you might think of programming in the place of a Schubert symphony or one of the smaller Beethoven symphonies. And then there are composers who I always want to know more of, like Augusta Olmez wrote a lot of operas, and there's a recording of some of her tone poems, but I think she has a lot more music that has not been explored. And when I say operas, I think there's always like instrumental tone poems that can be extracted from these things the way people do with, you know, I don't know, from the operas of like Benjamin Britten or, you know, Puccini or stuff like that. Like Ethel Smyth's been in the news a lot because, you know, she was the other composer that the Met Opera in New York City performed one of her operas in 1903. And then there was this big gap until they did Kaija Saariaho's opera last fall. So that big gap between 1903 and 2016, which was really alarming, you know, when there are so many women who did write operas, you know, including in the past. But anyway, Ethel Smyth, I know there are some, you know, sort of entr'actes and overtures to her operas that work as instrumental pieces. And she also wrote instrumental pieces as well, like a really wonderful serenade. She didn't actually write something called a symphony, but she wrote a lot of other instrumental pieces that could be played.
Let's jump ahead to today. Do you work actively with contemporary composers, or are you focused mainly on the historical ones?
You know, I definitely am interested in contemporary composers. And, you know, we have a lot. We blog about them. We include them on our website. You know, Women's Philharmonic Advocacy, we have a website and we have a blog that we call Feminist in the Concert Hall. And we're updating that regularly with news about performances of, you know, women composers from today and from you know, all over, you know, and every time period and all over the world. And really, we see women today making such incredible achievements. And I guess that the latest news story was about the woman who just won the Pulitzer Prize, Du Yun. I think it's Yun, Du Yun. And this was like the first time where the finalists were all women, too. So it's like women have been winning the Pulitzer Prize. Really, there's been quite a few in recent years. And so that's a wonderful thing. Of course, then you also get some backlash, like a friend of mine who teaches at the Berkeley School of Music, Berklee College of Music, she overheard some of her male colleagues say, oh, well, the Pulitzer's just totally devalued now when you have all these women, you know, winning it. You know, who cares about the Pulitzer anymore? So definitely women's philharmonic advocacy. I mean, we really want to work for women because we really feel like it's like women composers today benefit from having this knowledge about the historic women. And also, I think it helps with our, you know, our slogan of leveling the playing field. If people realize this is not just some new idea, you know, let's look around and find some women. Well, there have always been women composers, and we just have to get, you know, used to having them, and, you know, and kind of take it for granted and not think of it all the time as some novelty and something that we have to invent. You know, we have to get away from always reinventing that wheel. With the opera, I guess I'm going to go to Canada, to Toronto, to hear a small company, an opera company that's doing two of the one-act operas by F.O. Smythe. And so I just really want to champion opera companies here to do, you know, Smythe's music and to look for music by the women composers. And, you know, because opera, you know, is one of these sort of these big genres. But, you know, I mean, instrumental groups could also look for, get these kind of, you know, these excerpts and these overtures and things like that that can be extracted. And there is a 19th century woman who wrote a great opera. Here we go. Louise Bertin, La Esmeralda. And she wrote this in the 1840s. And it's long because it's on like two CDs. And Victor Hugo wrote the libretto. And so this would be something that you know, an opera company could explore, but also I think getting some instrumental excerpts from pieces like that. So I just think there's so much to explore, you know, because people a lot of times will say, oh, we have to do women of the past, like, you know, Fanny Mendelssohn and Clara Schumann, you know, and it's like, well, there are so many other composers and who I think are really great composers who are women from that era, you know, who don't get the name recognition of Fanny Mendelssohn and Clara Schumann. And so they don't have that sort of name recognition advantage, but, you know, they're also writing a lot of really interesting and exciting music.
That was Leanne Curtis, founder of the Women's Philharmonic Advocacy and president of its board of directors. You can find their website at wophil.org. More information about the Amy Beach Sesquicentennial is available at amybeach.org. Among upcoming performances of the Gaelic Symphony include one on May 6th in Princeton by the Westminster Community Orchestra, of which I am a member, a concert May 7th by Milwaukee's Festival City Symphony, and several performances in October by Symphony New Hampshire, which will pair it with Dvorak's New World Symphony. I hope you appreciate the conversations I bring you each week on A Tempo and all of the other high-quality programs of the award-winning Classical Network. Remember, these programs are possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for joining me for A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. You can find an archive of recent shows anytime on our webcast page at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the challenges and innovations facing the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of the listener members of the Classical Network.